Welcome to Lost River Legends. Our motto, Ex Tenebris, is Latin for out of the shadows. We attempt to understand the complex world around us and bring light to subjects hidden in darkness. We explore paranormal topics with guests from all around the world. Now welcome your Lost River Legends hosts, James and Brett. We hope you enjoy the show.
Sheehan, author of Bigfoot Terror in the Woods Sightings and Encounters, and you're listening to Lost River Legends.
UFOs, ghosts, Bigfoot, and I believe it's all connected on some level.
I've often joked that Sasquatch or Bigfoot, at some variation of it, has been seen on every continent except Antarctica. And then I always make the joke, there's probably one down there clubbing penguins.
They are then sort of either consciously or unconsciously looking for evidence that will help back that up.
He then clenched his fists, which were the size of basketballs, and showed me his teeth. It was then that I pulled the trigger, and he fell to the ground, holding his throat and screaming. The beast was back on its feet and screaming, with blood pouring down its chest.
Welcome to your Friday and to the latest episode from Lost River Legends. My name is Brett, and I'm one of the hosts of the show. James, our other host, will be joining us in just a moment. If you're a new listener to the podcast, we just want to say welcome to the show and thanks for finding us. We hope you enjoy. And for those listening, Lost River Legends is on the lookout for UFO sightings. So, if you've seen lights in the sky, a UFO, or other strange aerial phenomenon, we'd like to hear about it. Shoot us an email at lostriverlegends@gmail.com. And for today's interview, James and I sit down with W.J. Sheehan, better known as Bill Sheehan. Bill is the author of a series of books titled Bigfoot, Terror in the Woods, Sightings and Encounters. We're grateful for Bill's time, and it's always a pleasure to have him on the show. And as Lost River Legends continues to grow, so do the topics of interest that we'd like to cover. So James and I will be dipping our proverbial feet into the subject of UFOs for upcoming shows. Are UFOs tangible craft, or are they mental projections? Are they made by man, or are they sent here as reconnaissance vehicles from another planet? These are just some of the questions we hope to answer as we shift gears and we step onto a new path of topics. And with that being said, let's get right into part one of our interview with W.J. Sheehan. Enjoy the show.
Welcome to Lost River Legends. We're joined by Bill Sheehan of Bigfoot Terror in the Woods, and we're here for a Bigfoot extravaganza. Bill, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. It's good to be with you again and to be talking things Bigfoot with you and your audience. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, you're a big fan favorite. I'd have to say your episode's one of the most listened to. We're making some traction here with some of the other guests that we've had on, but people still come back to your episodes and really latch on.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, I mean, a lot of time and effort goes into what I'm doing. And aside from the nasty comments, oh, this guy's a big blowhard, where's the evidence, where are the photographs, there's a lot of people out there that are appreciating what's going on here. And you two guys are a couple of them. So I really appreciate the interest and giving us a platform to share on.
Thank you. For those who haven't heard the show before, can you give them just kind of a little quick bio?
Well, I got involved in this many years ago. I mean, my interest was sparked by the Patterson-Gimlin film clips or still shots of that many, many years ago. And, you know, that kind of carried along. There really wasn't much to look at or to read about. Or maybe it was just at the time I wasn't looking. But I think maybe in the 70s we had In Search Of. Was that the show with Leonard Nimoy, the guy who played Spock in Star Trek?
Yes. Yep. That's the correct show.
Yeah. So I think he was doing something on there about Bigfoot. And of course, I caught that back then and was excited about, you know, what they had to offer. But, you know, there really wasn't a lot through the years. We were kind of seeing reruns of pretty much the same stuff we had seen. And then, of course, the advent of the internet just blew the roof off of this thing. But then again, there's no pleasing the non-believer, because back then it was, oh, a couple of cowboys just happened to have a movie camera in their saddlebag. So that was no good that they happened to have that. And then when you see a blurry and shaky picture, that's no good either. How come they can't steady the camera and give us a good shot? And then when you get a perfect picture, oh, that's too flawless. It's CG. That was staged, a hoax. And, you know, all along, I'm not pessimistic that way. I just kind of believed in this creature. I believed what people were saying and doing. To me, it wasn't like watching the Frankenstein movie. I knew that was fake. And I really believed that this was real. And I just followed through with that. And some time ago, I started to gather and put together information. And the flame was struck, the match was lit, and I buckled down some time ago to start putting together all of this data into a book form, where basically, you know, people say, well, you wrote a lot in a short amount of time. It's not all that difficult once you have your ducks lined up, because I'm not writing a sci-fi story trying to get the storyline from landing on Mars to the rescue ship coming. You know, I'm just going with individual accounts, some of them, as you know, that are very brief, and others are slightly more elaborate. But I'm not trying to make anything more out of these than is there. I mean, if it takes me 5 minutes to read it, so be it. That's what it is. If it takes me 10 minutes to read it, so be it. That's the account, you know. I'm not trying to add pages to the books. I'm not trying to really embellish anything beyond what it is. I just tried to make something out of it that was readable and, you know, most people could digest it and put it in their pocket and say, all right, well, let me think about that for a little bit. And really, that's all we could do is think about it.
Yeah, and I think you do an excellent job making those, you know, getting it edited down to a good bite-sized chunk. You know, I can read two or three of them on my lunch break. I can read one before I nod off to bed. Might affect my dreams, but...
Well, you know, I want to say something, too. When you say doing an excellent job, I have to say something in my own defense. You know, I do all the writing myself. I'm working on a word processor. And then I kind of reread what I've done 2, 3, 4, 5 times, try to find my own mistakes. And then I pass what I do on. I have two different college graduate ladies who proof things for me. And in spite of all of those readings, I'm always finding errors in the text, even as I'm reading them, you know, having released them. And some people comment, oh, there's errors in there and this and that, the punctuation. And I'm like, you know, get over it. Just pretend you're reading a letter that your husband wrote and mailed to you across the country. You know, I know there's some little mistakes in there and whatnot, but, you know, get over it and enjoy the meat of the story that's there, because you know, the alternative is to pay a professional service to edit for you. You're looking for the books like I have, $4,000 to $5,000.
No, that's no small amount.
Yeah, $4,000 to $5,000 a book. So, you know, I don't know about anybody else, and I'm sorry to those who think it's too much to run across, you know, punctuation mark out of place or an and that should have been a but or whatever, but my apologies. My apologies, but to me, I think they come off pretty good, you know.
Well, and you're in book number, you have 6 books out and book 7 about to hit, or you're work, or is it the other way around where you've got...
Well, I'm in the middle. I'm in the middle of putting together book 7 right now. And I kind of put the brakes on a little bit. I was going like a fiend. I basically gave up all fishing and shooting last year. More than a year. I mean, I'm not even keeping track of the time, but I gave up pretty much everything I was doing, almost all of my available spare time, be it morning, evening, days off, was spent working on the books. And I just decided in my mind and in my heart when I put 6 out, I said, okay, take a deep breath and just chill out. This is a marathon. It's not a sprint. I have a lot more material, but I'm not going to press it the way I did initially. So, like, for instance, this year, even though I'm in the middle of writing 7, I decided I'm not going to do any more overtime at work. And this year I'm going to be taking in some bass fishing and getting back on the shooting circuit and just kind of let things roll out in a more normal manner.
Well, that sounds like a good plan. And you know what they say, all work and no play makes Bill a...
Go ahead.
Makes Bill a dull boy.
You got to finish it up, man.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Yeah, no, you know, my wife and I, it's just the two of us. So we don't have to entertain each other and whatnot. We live a good life. And thank God for my wife. In spite of our differences, you know, we get along like two peas in a pod. And it's no pressure on me one way or the other to do anything in particular. She gets what I do, and man, I could close the door and stay on my computer all day, and she would just say, hey, you want a cup of coffee? You know, it's not like I exit my computer and I'm getting the evil eye for ignoring her, you know?
Right, yeah.
So, I'm blessed. I'm blessed in that way to have the right woman for what I do, you know, and who I am.
That's key. That's key. Well, without any further ado, we'd like to launch into the extravaganza, whatever you have planned, and we'll just kind of let you go, and we'll interject after kind of each story. So we appreciate your time and your intro there, and we love having you on.
No, I appreciate it. And this particular account was tailor-made for you guys, and I said to Brett when we last spoke, I said, what do you know about Priest Lake, or do you know of Priest Lake? And I have to ask you, coming into this, before I get reading here, have you heard of anything going on around or about that particular area, Priest Lake?
I personally haven't had much. I know where Priest Lake is. I don't have any insights into any sightings up there, but it's really close to. I used to live in the Spokane area, and there were several sightings in that area. And that's kind of, you know, as the crow flies, it's probably like 50 miles. But the way that the mountain ranges are, it's not as accessible.
Yeah, have you read? Now, I could talk to you about this later. I don't have the account in front of me to give it to you verbatim. But have you read in my book, The Shapeshifter?
No, that one hasn't rang a bell for me yet.
Okay, anyways, that happened in Spokane or right at Spokane. Anyways, what I got for you tonight is just going to blow your mind. It has a religious connotation to it, which doesn't bother me in the least. And if it bothers your audience, too bad.
Right.
I named this particular account The Preacher Man. And you're going to hear why shortly. This account, quite frankly, has been placed by me in what I would say is the top 10 strangest accounts that I have heard to date. And yet, John Rogers, who told me this account, was a straightforward, clean-cut businessman from Idaho. He had a straight face. That coupled with what I would say was a calm, forthright demeanor, he told me the following story. The dates of this occurrence of which I speak were August 23rd and 24th of 1985. This being a weekend which I had planned to do a bit of hunting in the timber. I had hiked into an area which was due east of Bonner's Ferry and along the shores of all places, Priest Lake. As you will soon hear, the lake by which I was hunting was more than aptly named for what was about to happen. It was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon when I was walking through some well-dispersed timber, heading up a slope that was before me. I could see reasonably well in here, with there being virtually no low growth in this area. As I was hiking, my eyes picked up on some dark black shape coming through the forest and heading towards me. At this point, I had only caught a glimpse of black coloring, which froze me in my tracks. Dropping my rifle's barrel towards the color, I saw it was a man. He was now in full view, having cleared the trees that were disrupting my seeing him fully. As I was focusing on him, I realized he was a priest or a minister of some kind, and he was walking directly towards me. I remember holding my hand to my head and thinking to myself, "What's wrong with you?" 2 minutes later, he was standing in front of me and said, "Beautiful day, isn't it?" And I said to him, "What are you doing out here?" He replied, "The work of the Lord." I then asked him where he had come from and why he wasn't carrying a gun, to which he said, "I'm frequently in the forest and I'm never worried. The Lord protects those who belong to him." This man, who I now believe was a Catholic priest, was wearing a flat-top brimmed hat, a long black garment down to his feet, and there was a large crucifix hanging from his neck with the corpus of Jesus affixed to it. He was also wearing a pair of oblong-shaped wire-rimmed glasses. His overall appearance was that of a preacher from the 1800s. Staring me right in the eyes in a way where it seemed like he was looking right through me, he said, "When you find yourself in trouble, they that call upon the name of the Lord will be saved." He turned, walked away, and said, "Good luck with the hunt, and remember to to pray always. Where do you hear the rest of this? With that instruction, he walked away. I should also mention that when he stood before me, we had exchanged a handshake, and he was, in fact, flesh and bones. As you would well imagine, I didn't know what to make out of this encounter, and yet it had most certainly happened. When I made it back to my truck, I actually had a little Bible in my glove box, so I took it out. I laid it on the seat, and it flipped open when I put it down. Call it fate or whatever you want, but my eyes were suddenly drawn to a scripture that was before me now on the page, which read as follows: "Be not forgetful to entertain strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware." After reading this, I sat there pondering all that had happened. The following day, I made my way back into an area near the southeast tip of Priest Lake, and I couldn't stop thinking about the priest from the day before. When I looked at my watch, it was once again 1 o'clock, which was the exact time I had seen the priest the day before. I had to take a squat to relieve myself, so I kicked open a hole in the dirt. I had my rifle leaning against a tree and was squatting with my pants pulled down. Suddenly, I heard a grunt. When I looked to my left, a Sasquatch of the most immense proportions was staring at me some 30 feet away. Where he had come from, I had no idea. He looked like the devil himself and was staring at me in a way that said, "Now I've got you." I tried to stand up, being in the middle of you know what, attempting to pull my pants up, and the creature began to move towards me, snarling. I started praying out loud. "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us, Lord, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil." As soon as I had finished saying, "Deliver us from evil," the Sasquatch let out the loudest and most hideous shrieking scream that you could imagine and ran, not walked, into the trees at a rate that is not humanly imaginable. I was left standing there with crap literally running down my pants legs and trembling as the words of the priest were ringing through my very soul. "Remember to pray always. The Lord protects those who belong to him." I left the woods that day shaken and battered mentally. Making my way back to the truck, when I had made it back home, my wife said to me, "You stink, man. Take those clothes off and go take a shower now." I said that I would explain later. To this day, I have no idea how that Sasquatch had gotten that close to me without my seeing it. It stood about 11 feet tall and was built like a brick, you know what. His hair was dark brown with what I will describe as maroon highlights. The facial expression which it was making at me, was that of a demon from hell, a Halloween mask that would frighten anyone. His upper brow ran high up into the hairline, and he was bald throughout the entire middle of his skull, which was cone-shaped. His nose must have been 4 inches wide and laid flat against the face. When he turned to run, he left me like a dragster leaving the starting line, and that's no lie. he was faster than a horse at full gallop. That's the preacher man.
Wow. That is, that's just crazy. I mean, this is, it really puts you in his shoes, so to speak, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way it falls out and this preacher character walking around in the woods and the warning and the casualness of the meeting and this and that. And I was, you know, see, I firmly believe that there is a demonic part to the Bigfoot. And I've said this before and I'll say it again. It's just in my own person, I believe there's the real and the fake, there's the natural and the mimicked. And when I read and when I put forth something like you've just heard, I say to myself, what else is there given that set of circumstances than that? When I read that story, I think about an exorcism. The rites of exorcism, the ritual is performed in the presence of the person after having exhausted everything else as far as them being mentally unstable or psychological, medical, drug-induced problems. When they've exhausted everything and they decide to do the rite of exorcism, when people start to have the prayers prayed over them that are possessed, where there is something going on here, something deep and dark, they just start to flip out. And when this guy started to pray what he knew, when he got to the end and was saying, deliver us from evil, this thing freaking exploded and took off out of the area. So it's a very very unusual account. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, it kind of harkens to a lot of accounts where there is that evil feeling, that gloom, and it's something on, you know, it's something on the same dimensional plane, whether it's, you know, a spiritual connection. You know, because we know that there's various influences here on this planet. You know, is it that? Is it something you know, that's interdimensional that comes through into this dimension and is trying to violate our space, our dimension? So those are some thoughts that come out of that.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. Many, many, many people get the creeps when these things are around. You hear things like, my hair stood up. I didn't want to be there anymore. I felt like I was going to die. In my story, The Bone Pile, the doctor said a feeling came over him that he may even lose his life. And when that feeling hit him, he was alone deep into his hike. As he said, there was no turning and running out of there with his gear. So he took a moment to try to compose himself, feeling like, you know, this was getting the best of him. And then after about whatever it was, 10, 15, 20 minutes, he felt he had stabilized and continued on. To the point where he came across the bone pile, and then things really got out of control. So, you know, I don't know about you. How many times in your life do you really feel like, you know, I'm in imminent danger where I am right now? It's not that often.
Yeah, Bill, I completely agree with everything you're saying. And for the fact that you feel like these creatures are demonic in nature, personally, I couldn't agree with you more. I know that there's some accounts that, you know, these people say that they're these friendly forest giants and they're really nice and it saved me from an animal attack or whatever. But the bulk of these encounters are dangerous, are life-threatening, and some people have been killed by them. And for the fact that you mentioned that they're demonic, and they, you know, like we, you know, Satan is like the master imitator, right? He can mimic anything he wants, and I feel like anything that's demonic can do the same thing. They can act friendly and nice, but what's their real intent? And I feel like that, from my understanding of these creatures, most of them are wicked.
Yeah, and you know, like this whole shapeshifter phenomena, which I told you about, I have this one account actually called the shapeshifter. This is not normal. This is, you know, when people talk about these shapeshifters being able to turn from a wolf into looking like your grandmother, including her clothing, and people being called into the woods, you know, follow me, you know, disappearing. This is not normal behavior. This is not a natural thing, my friend. You know, if you see something, I had the account of the disappearing man. One of the most bizarre things you'll ever hear in your life. And by the way, that's another one in the top 10, along with this preacher man, the disappearing man. These guys saw a Bigfoot. Maybe I'll save that. Maybe we'll talk about that story a little later, and I'll save it for the listeners so you can hear the whole thing in its entirety. But definitely, there's definitely an element here. Now, don't get me wrong. In my opinion, I had one of the most telling things to me was the account in which I had the Russian professor and his landscaper who went out hiking together. And they came across a couple of Bigfoots that were actually tearing trees down in the woods and heard them gabbering. And the Russian professor said that he believed they were speaking in a Siberian dialect of which he was unfamiliar. That was really bizarre. And I was just looking into a hunting show, actually on television. I won't tell you the name of the show, but these guys were hunting over in Russia for what they believed were the elk's ancestors that are now living in North America. So this idea of this bridge over the Bering Strait, whether it was a continuum of the Aleutian Islands when the continents were more tightly together, you know, this idea of things traveling from North America over to Russia and back and forth, they were talking about the same thing in reference to this elk that they were going to hunt. So who knows? I don't know what to say about that. Maybe these creatures were over there at one time and came over here. You know, the abominable snowman creature, the Yeti, what were the other names they have for it? Maybe they were there and came here. Maybe there was some here and some there, and the two have intermixed. I have no idea. It's just total speculation, you know?
Right. And, you know, I think that there's... We've found that there's different types, you know, different face shapes, different characteristics, different things that they exhibit. So that for me, that makes it harder to 100% say this is 100% demonic. And, you know, I think it's harder for me to do that with the diversity that there is. But
you know, my school of thought is I don't think these things are 100% demonic. I think there's a portion of it that is, and then there's the real deal. So it's not, don't get me wrong, I don't think personally that this entire thing is demonic at all. You know, demons don't leave scat piles. Demons don't have matted fur on them. They don't leave footprints. they don't rip doors off of barns and destroy hen houses. You know, I don't think a demon has to eat too much during the day.
Sure, sure. Well, and you know, you think about, you know, okay, so God set things in motion, and he created, you know, he created the animals and commanded them to reproduce and commanded them to live out their days, and they basically do that to a T. You know, they're pretty obedient if you think about that. And then,
yep.
You know, you have man who can make choices and is judged and is given, you know, dominion and that kind of a thing. So where do these fit into that? Are they making choice? You know, from what I understand, from what I've heard and gathered, is that they're making choices, cognitive choices based on, you know, whatever input. You know, I wouldn't chalk it up to 100% instinct on some of these things.
Well, I mean, you know, I was having this conversation with somebody a while ago about a simple raven being able to solve a 6-piece puzzle. Now, that's a pretty strange phenomenon, you know, that they can do, you know, a somewhat complex thing for a creature in nature, you know, a 6-piece puzzle. And these creatures obviously know some things. They're skilled at laying ambush. They seem to be learned about things in their area that are available, perhaps even seasonally. I don't know how much intelligence that takes, more than just something that's within them, you know, from birth. You know, I mean, if you're living in a countryside and you know that apples are on the orchard over here, you know, in the spring, and if I go to the river at this time of year, it's packed with salmon. And, I mean, you know, this behavior, you look at just the bears. When they emerge, they're looking for berries, you know, and then they go down to fatten up at the rivers before they go to hibernate. And, you know, if they're around dumpsters, they know how to open a dumpster and that there's stuff inside of it. You know, I just don't know how much intelligentsia is involved with that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I feel like there's arguments all over the place, you know. And one of the things that I wanted to ask you was, these things, they seem human, but they also seem animal. In the sense that they're obviously living out in the sticks, out in the middle of nowhere. They're surviving off the land. They don't have any clothes, no known tools that we know that they're using. Obviously, they're hairy. They look, in form, in general form, they look human. You know, 5 fingers, 5 toes, hands, feet, mouth, nose, whatnot. But Bill, what do you think? Do you feel like that they're more animal, or do you feel like that they're more human?
Oh, if you're asking me personally, I don't equate these things to being anything close to a human being at all. I mean, people okay. can say what they want. I mean, if you're asking me, they're an animal. And the only thing that makes us think about a human being is the fact that they stand on 2 legs and the arrangement of some of their features. Just, it's humanoid.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, no. I mean, there's no way these things are a human being to me, or some offshoot or offspring. Some people say they're fallen angels and all this stuff, man. You know, not in my book they are. You're welcome to believe that, but
sure.
But in my book, no, they were a creation, and they're here slipping under the radar screen. They're not easily found or even stumbled upon, and you know, I wouldn't expect any time soon to run into one unless it was completely accidental or you were allowing yourself to be in areas where they've been more than regularly. You know, a guy sent me a map I don't know if I had ever seen this map before, but a fellow I was talking to said, I'm going to send you over this map of Sasquatch sightings, U.S. and Canada. Now, it's not dated, but it's an overview of the North American continent, like a satellite shot. And it's very dark. The background is dark. And there are illuminated spots placed all over the country, apparently up until the point in time when this was made. Oh, there is a date on it, 2013. So as of 2013, on this map, they have these clusters of lights, and you can see some of them are very singular and some of them are really densely packed together. And it said 3,313 reports over 92 years. So this was from 1920 to 2013. Now, 3,000 and change reports. And of course, that doesn't count before then or up till now. And those are only people who reported them wherever this data was taken from and where they created this map. So, I mean, over 3,000 reports, and you got to figure for everybody who sees one and reports it, how many people have seen one and never said anything about it?
Yeah, you've got a vast amount of people that are holding on to that information. I think we've seen that, you know, with Sasquatch Chronicles that he... You know, how many of the people does he kind of have to, does he not have on the show for those that he does? I mean, I think it's kind of a, you know, one out of six will actually come on the show. So, you know, there's something to it there. That map, I believe, is a, it's a BFRO map and a guy that's kind of like a data visualization I don't know if a data scientist is probably the right word, but he does data visualizations, and those it's representative of that data as to best he can do, because he does that professionally. So that's, you know, and the interesting overlap there is also how closer are those to population? Where's that overlap? You know,
well, there is. I'll tell you right now, when I look at this map, and just through what's in my book, these creatures aren't necessarily far from home, my friend. I mean, you know, they're in areas where there is human habitation. It's not like everybody's in the boondocks, where nobody's around for miles and miles around. I mean, these things are being sighted in numbers in areas where there are quite a few human beings around. So, again, I don't know what's going on there. I don't know how they're hiding. I don't know how they're not seen. But there's no doubt about it that all of these creatures are not wandering around in the middle of nowhere. I have an account in one of my books called The Dumpster Diver. And just the gist of it without telling you the whole story. The kid was a newspaper boy, and he was working on the weekends after school in a scrap metal yard. I think it was in the early 70s. The Vietnam War was still going on. And when he realized how much money was involved with scrap, working for his father's friend in his scrap yard, he started going out early in the morning with his bicycle with the baskets on it and doing some dumpster diving and checking out people's trash cans before the garbage guy came. And he had a dumpster. This was down in Florida. He had a couple of dumpsters, like multi-dumpster platforms, whatever you want to call it, in like condo complexes or housing complexes, where there was like a number of dumpsters, and he found that these were being pretty profitable. In other words, he could go in there and typically come up with a sink and unbolt the faucets from it or find some aluminum or whatever, and he was making a buck. He came He had learned going into dumpsters, though, not to just approach them quickly, because lots of times there was animals in them, raccoons, you know, whatever. He would flip the lid open and something would come out and, you know, shout happy birthday to him. You know, so he had learned, before I go to the dumpsters, I throw a rock at them. So he hears some activity in this dumpster complex, and he chucks a rock at it, and a Bigfoot blows the lid off of the top of the dumpster. It was in the dumpster, blows the lid up the air, comes leaping out, looks around, and goes running off into the woods. Now, somebody in the complex heard the ruckus, came out, and basically an old guy read the riot act, you know, stop making noise around here, get out of here, kid. And he left. And when he told his father what happened, his father came back with him and looked at the dumpster. And when they were looking around the dumpster, sure shooting, they found some prints next to the dumpster. Just like the kid had said, these were big prints from when this thing had got out of the dumpster, hit the ground, and then went into the woods. So here's a Bigfoot doing what bears do, doing what raccoons do, jumping in a dumpster and rummaging around for something. You know, I mean, Florida, you know, not exactly British Columbia.
Yeah, and how many times do we hear the bear thing ascribed to Sasquatch? I mean, it's like the ultimate red herring. Very convenient.
Well, yeah, but listen, a bear doesn't leap out and land on 2 feet and run away into the woods. I mean, that's the ultimate in stupidity. Like, people don't know what a bear looks like. I mean, there is no question in my mind if I'm looking at a bear or if I had seen a Bigfoot. It's just, it's more absurd than saying I saw a Bigfoot to say I don't know the difference between an 8-foot-tall monster looks like a barn door running away on 2 feet. I mistook that for what in reality was a black bear. Come on. Yeah, it's just absurd.
Yeah,
you know, when people say, "Oh, well, some bears have been seen on hind legs." Yeah, have you ever seen a bear on their hind legs? They walk kind of goofy looking, with their arms held out. They look like they're Frankenstein. They're not nimble. They're not running, leaping, or anything. They look like a bear walking on their hind legs.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's such a huge difference, and you know, we've heard so many stories where that becomes kind of the what it gets falsely attributed to. And I think that, you know, people are smarter than that. People are more aware and more cognizant of their surroundings than they are given credit.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. You know, I want to read for you. This is a really interesting account. Came out of Manitoba, Canada. An evidential account. And when you hear these things, once again, you're going to see how stuff is being found by people who are in places where you and I are not. And let me just break into this with you. I named this account the Manitoba Evidence simply because it occurred in Manitoba. This following evidential account was brought to my attention by a woman named Ashley Levesque. This is Ashley's testimony regarding that which she and her girlfriend saw in the woods of Manitoba. "I am a freelance software engineer. Firms hire me as needed for periods that range from weeks to months to years, depending on what the work entails. Because of this makeshift lifestyle, I am afforded a fair amount of free time, which I generally use for exercise and adventure. Cross-country skiing and hiking are two of the things I enjoy most, However, I generally do not go far from home to do either of these. My home being a small chalet constructed on a plot of land abutting a protected wilderness. I don't remember exactly how much land lies behind me, but it is enormous and consists of millions of acres. So I typically hike and ski there. You couldn't ask for a better location, and in all of the years I have been living here, I have not so much as once run into another human being in the woods. In the winter of 2008, my best friend and I broke out the skis for some exercise. We never clock our distance or map our paths. The enormous amount of untouched land affords us a plethora of trails to follow, spanning out in any number of directions. And when the snow has fallen, the potential for pathways is virtually endless. Generally, we go as far as we feel we can while still having enough juice for the return trip home. Typically, I would say that we can travel between 15 and 20 miles in a single outing. On this day, we were skiing on pure virgin snow. And if you were to look around, the only visible marks on it were some small animal tracks here and there, having gotten 10 inches of the white stuff overnight, and the temperature was about 25 degrees Fahrenheit. We were fairly deep into our outbound ski when we came upon a debris field and quickly realized that what we were looking at was the strewn about remnants of a rotten tree's interior. We could see that the rotten wood and chips extended about 20 feet or so away from the tree, and it was clear that this destruction had happened this very morning because there wasn't so much as a flake of snow covering the debris, with the snow having stopped falling around 4 in the morning. We could clearly see that the entire area in front of the tree was completely matted down, indicative that something must have stood in front of this decayed tree for some time, as it tore apart its interior. We also noticed a straight line of gigantic footprints both coming to and moving away from the tree, which were fresh and similar in shape to those of a human. As we crouched down to examine them, we could clearly see toes, but they were slightly splayed apart. Additionally, the big toe was somewhat angled inward, unlike a human's. It was so perfectly imprinted in the snow that it almost looked like it had been cast, with many of the prints still having snow raised up between the individual toes. I snapped out of my skis and stood next to a print in order to size it up against my own. The footprint was approximately 12 inches longer than my ski boot, which would make its length around 24 inches. Its width behind the toes was about twice the size of mine, which would make that around 10 inches, though it could have been a bit more. Between the snow that had fallen overnight and that which had already been on the ground, there was about a foot of snow in total. This snow was completely compressed within the print, being pressed all the way down to the pine needles. Whatever this thing was had incredible bulk. Even with my boots on and jumping and stomping down on the snow, I couldn't come close to the degree of compression this thing had created while just casually walking. There was no melt in the prints, and very little snow had collapsed within them. They were very, very fresh. And because there was no wind that day, there was also no freshly blown snow covering the prints either. They were as perfect could be. The stride length of the creature that had left these was incredibly long. We laid one of the skis in the front of the toes on one print And even though my ski was about 7 feet long, it came up short of the next print by almost 2 feet. That made these steps almost 9 feet long from toe to toe. We decided to put our skis back on and try to follow the return trail for a while. It paralleled the entry trail for a mile or so before beginning to veer east into the woods, which leads to some heavily timbered forest. After about 2 miles or so, we ran across another tree that had been torn open. This one was nothing like the first, as it appeared that this thing had approached another tree, thinking that it was more rotten than it actually was. After it had dug into the... it had found that the tree was still fairly solid at its core. It was apparent to both of us that this thing had been walking through the timber and sampling decayed trees as the trail then continued outbound into the forest. Since there was no end in sight, we didn't want to follow the trail any further. Besides, whatever had left these tracks was walking with a 9-foot stride, we were not looking forward to greeting it in these woods. Now, I had heard of Bigfoot and seen some footage. I had also seen the footprints that supposedly belonged to the abominable snowman in the Himalayas. They went in a straight line across a mountain slope in the middle of nowhere. This beast must have been casually sauntering around in the timber and trying to scrounge up some food. I'm sure they have a number of things to survive on. Maybe whatever in those decayed trees is just another one of the many things that it eats. This experience has not prevented me from going into these woods, with many winters having passed since this occurred, and to this day, I have never seen another set of prints.
Wow, that's fascinating. And I want to say that's one of the biggest stride lengths I've ever heard.
That's ridiculous, you know. It's a freaking monster.
Yeah, and if it's sauntering at 9 feet apart.
You know, I don't know if we talked about the Tennessee tree stand incident. But just to talk about the size issue. And, of course, you know, it's like a witness reported an accident. You know, he said, she said. This guy in Tennessee claims that his tree stand was mounted 25 feet in the tree. Now, he was talking about the height of his head as the mount height. I think he said that he thought his feet in the tray were like at about 20 feet. Now, even if the guy was off, say he says, yeah, I was 25 feet in the tree. Well, what if he was 15 feet in the tree? And his head was really at 20 feet, and he's saying, I'm at 25 feet. This Bigfoot, the story is really interesting, but this Bigfoot snuck up behind him while other creatures out in front of him were distracting him, making noises like owls. And it gently grabbed the heel of his boot in the tray. So he says he was 25 and he thought his feet were at 20. And I say, what if his head was at 20 and his feet were at 15? Either way, something really big with really long arms had to be there to reach up and grab the heel of his boot in that tray. And when he looked down out of the tray, when he felt this thing grab him, this freaking Sasquatch was looking right up at him, grinning. And it let go of his boot and walked away down the trail. And when it did so, all of the distraction or these fake owl noises, as he described them, stopped. That was really bizarre.
Wow. And, you know, in perspective, You know, I think about like, okay, 10 feet. Well, you know, NBA players have to jump to get a ball in a hoop that's 10 feet. So then you go double that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even know, you know, I don't even know what to say about that. You know, and people can say, well, yeah, yeah, it sounds like a little horse crap. Look, I get it. A guy says 25, I'm saying, what if it was 20? What if it was 15 and he's saying 25? Yeah, you know what I'm saying? You're up in the tree, you're thinking back, you know, he's just 25 feet. All right, 25 feet. Any way you slice it, a really big creature had to be present under that tree to extend its arm up and grab hold of this guy's boot in that tray.
Yeah,
I don't hunt deer, but I've seen guys that do, and I know they're not putting their tree stand 10 feet off the ground. So what the common number is, I think the common number is whatever amount of labor you're willing to put into getting the thing up the tree. I think that's what the common number is. But, you know, we're not talking, a guy doesn't put his tree stand 10 feet up to sit there with his feet hanging down at 7 feet, trying to hit a deer that's standing off the ground 4 feet tall at its back, you know. It just doesn't make sense. They either smell you or see you, and you could forget about bow hunting, you know?
Right. Well, and I'd be losing my mind at that point. I mean, you're out there thinking you're alone. You're thinking that you're going to see, you know, animals that you're familiar with and hoping to get the one that you're after. And it's just such a paradigm shift, you know, to see something looking up back at you.
Yeah, well, I say to people all the time relative to these Bigfoots, if I was ever able to see one, I would want it to be at a distance. If I could choose the circumstances, let it be at a distance where I can identify it and say, holy cow, there it goes. You know, and I wouldn't want to be close to one of these creatures. You don't know what's going to go on. You don't know if you're going to get out of there. You know, it's like getting close to a grizzly or something to me, you know. You don't know what's going to happen. And if they run at you, you're not outrunning them. It's simple. You know, when I was a kid, I used to have a paper route, and I knew some of the bad dogs on the route. And it was always the same people, irresponsible people, and it was always a vicious dog. It was never a cuddly little friendly thing that was left loose that would come over and let you scratch them. It was always some nasty beast that was left loose. And I knew I wasn't going to outrun them on my bicycle by the time they got over to me. Then they'd be snapping at your leg or something. So I'd get off the bike and use the bike as a barrier between me and them. Maybe grab a rock, you know, whatever I could get and whack them or try to smack them, flinging the bicycle at them or something, you know. But I'm only saying that because that's a dog. You know, people say these Bigfoots. I saw a film clip of a grizzly bear running down an antelope on the side of a mountain. People say these Bigfoot. This guy in that account, well, we didn't read that account yet, so I shouldn't say that to you. I have an account called the EMT and the Dead Marksman. Let me think about this now. No, it's not even that account. The name of this account slips me. He said that I'm just twisted here. I better get off the subject while I could, till I get my thoughts straight about it. But people claim the speed of these things is just incredible. And we also heard in The Preacher Man, he said it left him like a dragster jumping off the line. I mean, these things can get out of Dodge in a hurry. And if they were coming at you with ill intent, you could forget about getting away. You're not going anywhere, my friend.
Yeah, that's probably one of the most common themes with Bigfoot encounters, these Sasquatch encounters, is the speed involved, the stride length, and they can just go uphill, downhill, doesn't matter the terrain, doesn't matter how thick. I think the last time that you were on our show, you shared a story of one that came out of some bushes from some bird hunters, and I think you mentioned that the chest was as wide as 2 50-gallon drums welded together, and it's
That was from the pheasant hunters account.
Yeah, and you know, you see something that big, and it's just, it can walk through anything. There's nothing that's going to stop it, and for these things to run through a thicket and thorns and bushes and shrubs, it's incredible. And you know, what's interesting is on Facebook, I think it was last week, someone had shared there was a gentleman that was glassing the side of a hillside when he was hunting, and he noticed that there was a black bear. It was a male black bear, and it was downhill, and uphill there was a grizzly, a mama bear with its cub. And as soon as the scent of the male black bear hit the mother, she, and this is like probably, I don't know, a 30-degree incline, she's running downhill, full speed, going after this black bear. And this black bear hears this train wreck coming down the hill towards him. He scampers up a tree, and I'll be darned, this mama bear was on him in a matter of seconds. And so for a Sasquatch to even outrun in some instances, I mean, I think a grizzly can run as fast as a horse. And you mentioned previously that one of these could outrun a horse. And so, and these things are on two legs, and they're running down prey that's as quick as a horse. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, they according to some of the accounts, these things have the ability, if they work in teams or as a group or even individually, to run down herd animals. And I'm sure they're like, you know, a cheetah in Africa or a lion, where they would take the weaker if they could get it, the slower. I mean, that's always that way in the animal kingdom. But the fact that you even think you can attempt to take down your typical herd animals, which can just run like this, tells you something about them. I mean, these things can move. And move in a way that we are just unfamiliar with, you know.
It's pretty fascinating, and it's scary. It really is, because there's obviously nothing you can do. Most of us are not built for running on 2 feet at that kind of speed. Even our Olympians, I mean, they can move pretty dang quick, but these things could run down the greatest athletes with ease.
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, it's funny you mention that, because I was thinking the other day, I wonder what the number is on, like, a sprinter. You know, and even if you're talking 100-yard dash Olympic-wise, what is it in MPH? What do you think, 20 miles an hour?
I want to say it's... Man? Yeah, I want to say, like, Usain Bolt, if I'm saying his name right. I want to say, and I think James is going to look it up here really quick, but I want to say it's over 25 miles an hour, the top speed. But we'll see if we can verify that. But
yeah, but it wouldn't be sustained. In other words, he's not going to do
exactly
that for, you know, quarter of a mile.
Yep. And these things, they're running down elk, and I know that these animals, whether it's elk or deer, these hunters or people out in these woodsmen will encounter these animals, and these animals are just sweating like crazy. They're winded, and their legs are just done. And here comes the Bigfoot, and there's no report that I know of in these instances when the Bigfoot is winded and, you know, it's got its hands on its shoulders bent over and he's doing his thing.
Yeah, it's not like they're lacking stamina. Their muscles are so so over the top as far as their ability to climb and just to drive and keep going and going and going. People talk about these things climbing up hillsides that are like ridiculous for people to get on, and you can see their prints just going up the side with no indication they were holding on to anything or their knuckles going down onto the ground, you know, just walking.
Yeah.
So, it's just crazy, you know.
So James just pulled it up. I think Usain Bolt, the fastest speed is just a hair over 27 miles an hour.
Wow, and that's booking.
That's booking, but that's a short, again, that's a short distance, a burst of speed, and then you're done. It is not a sustained long distance speed. And so
all you got to do is look at them at the end of the race. When they break the tape across the line, they slow right down. They got their hands, you know, they're kind of dragging along, heavy breathing, you know, just the cool down period, you know?
Yeah. You know, in the walking speed of these creatures, their pace, the shore you just aired, the stride length on these things when they're just walking is, it would be hard for a human to keep up because they're just, they're moving and even just at a walking pace.
Yeah, just, it's just ridiculous. You know, we can't, you can't measure up. You can't even fathom what it is we're talking about. It's just incredible. I watched a deer hightail it out around my house when they get spooked. I couldn't even think about chasing one of them, no matter what you are. I mean, they just go like boing, 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 and they're gone. I don't even know where they went. You know, it's a couple of quick hops. I mean, covered so much ground. It's just unfathomable thinking about chasing one of them and catching it. Not to mention evasive movements. Just on a straight line, if they were running through a tunnel and you were behind them, just to be able to catch them, it just seems like, you know, there's no way it's going to happen.
Yeah, I saw a video the other day. There was a deer striding along parallel to a car, and it decides to just, hey, I'm going to go on the other side of the road. And it clears the entire road, clears the car, lands on the other side unscathed. Just amazing.
Well, just unbelievable. Well, my friend Tom, my old fishing buddy, he had a deer leap over the hood of his pickup truck. Just a bound, like bang, 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 over the hood, not to the other side of the street. And that's, of course, how they get killed, you know, doing things like that. But they could just bound and cover distances like, you know, that we have no comprehension of how they do that, you know. He leaped over the hood of a running truck coming down an off-ramp on the road, airborne like Santa's reindeer, and kept going. But, yeah, so we know. I mean, obviously we know these animals just have incredible capabilities. You know, I'm looking through here. I have some things for you. You know, and you know, this is really interesting. In regards to the map, this overview of where things are and how they're seen, I have something here that to me really simplifies the idea of where these things potentially could be and who could potentially see them. So when we talk about, you know, this lady, okay, she's backed up against millions of acres in Manitoba. She's never seen anybody in there in all the years she's lived there back in the woods where she goes hiking and cross-country skiing. But here we have a totally different set of circumstances. And I named this account the barbecue sighting. It was told to me by a fellow named Kendrick Taylor, who's a resident of Pennsylvania. My wife and I had moved from Jersey, that's New Jersey, into western Pennsylvania. We purchased a small two-bedroom ranch nestled in the trees within a community of about 40 homes. With the exception of three houses in the neighborhood, all of the homes were backed up against a fairly extensive area of forest. We regularly had deer in and around the community, and we had heard that there was a periodic black bear sighting. So everyone was careful with their garbage. It was Friday evening in July when I had stoked up the barbecue on my rear deck. My deck was about 3 feet off the ground, and from its edge, there was more or less some 50 feet or so until my yard ended, meeting up with a slope that ran down into a hollow. Our own property was less than a half an acre, which didn't really matter because I was up against thousands of acres where our yard ended. I had laid out some sausages on the grill and closed the top to allow them to get going. Everyone knows that once those big Italian sausages start to sizzle, there can be a fair amount of smoke as the fat starts to hit the coals. I stepped back into the kitchen to get a few other things ready for dinner and came back out to turn the sausages. When I did so, there was a plume of smoke wafting out of the barbecue and drifting with the wind out over the backyard. I then closed the lid and went back inside. After about maybe 15 minutes had passed, I was starting to get a few sausages that were done ahead of the rest and began to place them on a platter which was sitting on the top rail of the deck. I went back inside yet again, knowing that on my next trip out, all would be ready. Grabbing a few more things, I was just stepping out when I realized, let me just get my page here, when I realized I had forgotten to bring something else with me, and I turned to go back into the house. Now having everything in hand to indulge in our little feast on the deck, I was coming back out, and when I turned my head, a Bigfoot was standing behind my barbecue on the other side of the railing. Dropping everything I had in my hands, I ran into the kitchen, locking the door behind me. I remember my wife looking at me saying, "What the heck happened? What are you doing?" I grabbed the phone and dialed 911, telling the operator there was a Bigfoot in my yard. Who knows what she thought, but she said they would send a car right over. While I was waiting and trying to explain to my wife what had happened, I tried to sneak over by the windows and see if I could see anything without being seen myself. I kept thinking that at any moment, its face would appear looking back at me through the glass. I'm telling you right now that the locked doors and closed windows would be no defense against what I saw. If this Bigfoot wanted to be in our house, it would be. The police were there in 5 minutes, and I was shouting and waving my hands to be careful. The officers walked straight into the backyard, and I fully expected gunshots to erupt at any second, but they didn't. Maybe 2 minutes later, they were at my back door with their guns holstered. I stepped out onto the deck as they were asking me what had happened. It was then that I saw the platter of sausages had been knocked off the rail and was laying on the grass. All of the cooked sausages were gone. Well, you could just imagine what these cops were thinking as I started to tell them about a Bigfoot eating my sausages while I was barbecuing on the deck. Thank God that they were able to notice that something had clearly walked up from this hollow behind the house, because my lawn was all trampled down from the deck to the corner of the yard. To be honest with you, the police really didn't do a whole lot, or really did a whole lot of nothing, and left, after which I broke out my tape measure to figure out how big this thing was. From the ground to the top of the deck was 36 inches. And from the top of the deck to the top rail was another 36 inches. This Bigfoot was at least a foot taller than me when I was on the deck, and I'm 6 feet 2 inches tall. So this beast was about 10 feet tall and maybe 5 feet wide at the shoulders. Even though I turned and ran in a flash, it was only 15 feet away from me when I saw it straight on. Its fur was like a very dark battleship gray with a lot of white hairs mixed in. All of the hair was fairly long and stuck together in clumps. It just stood there when I popped out of the door as though it would have stayed for dinner if I didn't run, almost like a dog sitting by the table waiting for some handouts. I lost my place. Sitting by the table looking for some handouts. The fact that it had grabbed about a dozen sausages before dropping the platter on the grass was insane. I did look down into this hollow area and could see a well-worn trail both up the hill towards my yard and through the bottom of the hollow. But as I said before, we do have a lot of deer around here. My wife and I put the house up for sale a short time later. I was so uncomfortable around the house that we just couldn't stay there anymore. Every time I pulled in the driveway at night or mowed the lawn, I couldn't stop looking over my shoulder, and you could forget about barbecuing altogether. The enormous size of this thing said that it could have torn the entire deck from my house if it wanted to. It looked like a living piece of heavy equipment, like a dozer or a payloader. Its arms were massive beyond description, like pieces of tree limbs joined together. The face was kind of bearded, and it had some hair coming in from the sides of its head onto its cheek area, forming a point. The nose was maybe 3 or 4 inches wide and flat against the face, and its mouth was closed. I would say that the eyeballs were somewhere between the size of a golf ball and a handball, jet black and glassy, and it leered at me with a blank stare. This was the most frightening thing that you could ever imagine, and it had happened to me.
You know, that lends a lot of credence to the whole trickster element of Sasquatch, but also the opportunistic side, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's... You know, first of all, the ability to smell. I mean, I think any creature gets familiar with stuff in their area. You know, we smell food, right? You go past a restaurant, it's got the grill on or something, you know, that smoke comes wafting out, and you're like, whoa, steak, you know.
And well, especially...
Whatever it is, you know, you'll get a nose full of it. And I guess if you were hungry and if you're used to eating things that aren't cooked and you got a whiff of that, you might say to yourself, wow, that smells pretty good, you know?
Yeah, I was just going to say, especially when you're hungry, everything sounds so much better. And if you have someone that's very opportunistic, they're going to take advantage of that. You know, the goofy side of me was hoping that you would end that with, yeah, the cops walk around back, and the Sasquatch had the barbecue fork, and he's flipping the sausages,
yeah.
And
donning
an apron.
I think the thing got caught off guard. Maybe it was making a move, not expecting the guy to come out. Perhaps it hadn't seen him on the deck and going back into the house. It was just being drawn to the smoke and the smell. And then suddenly this guy comes out and it just said, well, you know, this is why I think they don't have a lot of intelligence. Because I don't know. You know, it's just standing there like, you know, oops. You know, what to do.
Kind of like a little kid, you know, caught with the hand in the cookie jar.
That kind of thing. Yeah, that's a good point. Like a little kid, like, you know, and they stand there and kind of look around. They're not really mature enough to explain the situation, you know, right off the bat. They're just kind of hanging out, like waiting to be reprimanded, you know, or something, you know. But when the guy went back in, this thing split, and it took the sausages with it. Which, you know, it's just incredible, you know. I mean, it's still doing up, you know, get what you came here for, you know.
You know, we're sitting here just laughing because it's such a funny story, you know. I'm thinking of Sasquatch packing off a whole pack of Johnsonville, you know, bratwursts.
Yeah. Yeah, the fat bastard eating a dozen sausages, you know. He didn't leave any for me.
Well, yeah.
Oh, man.
I'm left with the beer and the rolls.
Right.
Absolutely crazy, you know. But, you know, again, this is I have another account in New Jersey. I won't read the whole account to you, but I'll tell you basically what happened. And again, this is around a neighborhood, a residential area, a lot of homes, not big pieces of property, you know, some woods around, but we're talking a community here, you know, of pretty tightly packed homes. Like, this guy said he only had 50 feet from the back of his deck to where this property dropped off into this hollow. But in this New Jersey encounter, these people lived in a very nice neighborhood. And they said that people for a couple of years were putting posters up on telephone poles of missing dogs. And it had gotten to the point where somebody even commented on a local news broadcast, like, you know, another dog was stolen from, you know, whatever, Smithsville, you know. They thought they had a dog thief working the area. And the reason being that this was a pretty well-to-do area, and most of the dogs that were taken were pedigree. So they were worth a couple of bucks. It wasn't like a mutt from the pound. And in spite of all of this dog thievery or missing dogs going on, this couple still had their heart set on getting a dog, and they bought this German Shepherd. So the husband had taken what I'll call a screw. I don't know if you've ever seen these. I've seen these used in the railroad for tie downs on poles. They're like large galvanized screws, maybe 4 feet long, 5 feet long, that you have to turn into the ground with like a pole through the eyelet.
Yeah,
they get wound down as like an anchor.
Right.
So he puts one of these screws into the backyard, hooks a piece of welded chain up to it with a brass snap on the end of it to hook on the dog's choke collar. Now, he told me that the deer in the woods used to taunt his dog. They knew that the dog was on a leash and that if he ran to the end, he went flying up in the air, choking himself, and that he couldn't get them. So they would come, you know, traipsing through the edge of the forest, looking at him. He'd bark and bark and bark and then, you know, to the end of the chain and choke himself. Well, that went on for a while, and then the dog, of course, would bark at other things, squirrels and whatnot. Well, one day, it was raining, and the husband had kept the chain up by the back door. His plan was just to put the dog out, let him run around in the rain, take care of his business, and then go to the back door and let him back in. He went upstairs, was working on his computer, and time went by, and he was like, holy smokes. And he yelled down to his wife, honey, did you let the dog in? She said, no, I thought you did. He comes downstairs, opens the door, no dog. And there's the chain laying out in the yard. It's raining. He goes out there. He's shouting for the dog. He walks over by the chain, and the chain is snapped. And his first thought was, if it was a dog thief, all they'd have to do is open the snap. You know, you don't break. First of all, it's a welded chain. You don't just break that. And he looked down, and there was a large footprint with rainwater in it right near where the incident had occurred. And then he knew, he put two and two together, that this had to be what they call Bigfoot. Came over here and snatching the animals out of the yards in this neighborhood. And now it was his dog. So when you talk about the intelligence of these creatures, this creature couldn't figure out how to open a snap and get it off the dog. It went up to the chain and just like, ugh, boom, you're coming with me. Just like tore it off. And that was the end of it. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there you have a couple of things. You have creatures coming into residential areas. And to me, you have a sign of really a lack of intelligence. In that it wasn't capable of looking or manipulating a snap or realizing what it was looking at, this mechanical device, and how to do something with it.
Yeah, and you've got just that tremendous feat of strength, though. I mean, you've got to think some of those chains are like tungsten carbide, and they're, you know, they're not easy to break, even if you're pulling, you know, two cars in opposite directions. So that's a lot of force.
Oh, it's ridiculous. I mean, you know, do you remember, like, we used to call it the swing set chain? Do you remember that old skinny link chain that used to come in, like, a home variety of a swing set?
Yep.
They were very narrow lengths, like, kind of twisted around together and stuff. I would consider that a small or a weak chain, but it could support you swinging and never break. You could have that swing set for 20 years and never break. And there was no way... no way you were going to pull that chain apart by hand. So I'm sure this wasn't a freaking anchor chain this guy had on the dog, but he said it was a welded link. So irregardless of whatever type of chain it is, it's chain. Even the old sash weight chains and whatnot, the little brass ones, there's no way. You'll cut your hands. You'll tear your finger off trying to wrap it around it and pull it apart before you'd break one of those things. And they were only a quarter of an inch in diameter. So whatever this thing was had incredible strength to snap a chain clear and take the dog at the same time.
Yeah, and who knows? You know, it could have been, you know, something that took him a little bit of time to work at it, you know, could have been a 5-minute feat, could have been longer, could have been a 2-second snatch, you know, you just never know.
Yeah. Yep. You know, that's pretty much where it goes with that. You know, these things are opportunistic. They seem to know what's going on in their area. Be it seasonal or presented to them. I have a number of accounts with chicken coops, hen houses, pigs. A beekeeper had his hives busted into. I mean, they know what's going on in their area, just like any other creature snooping around knows. They know when it's harvest time. They know when they can get corn. They know when they can grab a pumpkin. They know when they can grab fruit on the tree. If they look at the tree and see something, they know it may be edible, and they go over. And this is going on. You know, I mean, animals, grubs, fish, they're definitely opportunistic, and they're survivors. They will eat whatever they can, wherever it's made available. And if it just happens to be your cat, Well, so long. You know, dinner.
Yeah, that
dinner tonight is your pet.
That's disturbing to think about. But I'm sure it happens.
You know, I have large red-tailed hawks around here, great horned owls. My wife was in the yard one day. She heard a screech, like a shriek. The red tail had nailed a feral cat in my neighbor's yard. She said the red tail was on top of it and the cat was screaming and somehow managed to get away from its talons. And we think the cat actually died under our deck a short time later because we started to get a stink over there like a dead animal. I think it ran away and there's like a block foundation that my deck is built on. We think it hopped up in there like as a point of escape and actually died in there. But here's a hawk, good-sized bird, coming down to kill a cat. Another night, I was riding down the street, and I came up to a street light on a dark corner, an individual street light illuminating this one corner of grass next to some pine trees. As I turned my head, you know how when you see a singular light somewhere in the darkness, it presents like a cone of light coming down?
Yeah.
As I turned my head, I saw a giant pair of talons clutching a full-size fat cottontail, lifting it straight up into the darkness and out of this cone of light. So that was a horned owl. I mean, I've seen these suckers up close at around sunset. And some of these bad boys are like, you know, 2 foot tall or better. And they're, you know, maybe 10, 12 inches broad, like a little jug, you know. And, you know, if one of them can take a cat or, you know, a 5 or 6 pound rabbit, you know, just it doesn't take much for you to lose your pet if you leave him outside, you know. You think about a Bigfoot, nothing, you know, there's just stomp the smack, you know, grab it and just crush it in their hand and it's all over, you know.
Yeah, a little nice bite-sized morsel for him. That kind of, you know, that story kind of reminds me of a story in book one, and it's a fisherman that has an encounter in Maine, I believe.
Oh, was that the man that was out trout fishing in his canoe? He was doing a lot of portaging?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, and that was interesting because if you recall the story, he was doing, the canoe was really more of a tool to get him where he wanted to go. Once he was there, he wasn't canoeing much. He was kind of portaging over this shallow stream / river and stopping at pools where he saw the fish. So he was pretty much just chilling out. But his thing was that he had caught some trout and was laying them on a flat stone, as I recall, back on the side of this creek or river. And when he turned around, the fish were gone. And he thought it was raccoons. So he had packed a bowl on his pipe and moved up the stream, as I recall, and he's puffing on the pipe and doing a little fishing. And this time, I think he put a couple of 2 or 3 fish over in the stone, and while he was smoking a bowl, he was keeping his eye out of the side of his peripheral vision, you know, like really, he was smoking his pipe, but he was watching to see if the raccoons would come back out. Well, this time, he saw that long, hairy arm and hand extend out from the brush alongside of the river, reaching out like a foot off of the ground. And he said that the hand opened up and clutched the entire pile of fish in one grasp and retracted back into the bushes. And, of course, when he saw that, he was just like, holy God. His tent was set up like, you know, whatever, 20, 30 feet away from where this arm had just extended. And even if he was going to get out of there and take his gear with him, he was going to have to go over there to break down the tent and get it in his canoe and then portage and paddle back out of here. So he was like going to be in harm's way. And he said that whatever this thing was had to have been laying on the ground, because the angle that the arm and the hand came out, the only way that could have been done was if you were crawling on your belly, getting yourself into position, and then just extending your arm straight out like a broom handle, grabbing it and pulling it, retracting it back in. I mean, you want to talk about a freak show. Can you imagine?
And that concludes part one of our two-part series with Bill Sheehan, author of Bigfoot Terror in the Woods, Sightings and Encounters. And stay tuned for part two, which will be released next week. And if you've had a strange or unexplained encounter with a paranormal, please contact us at lostriverlegends@gmail.com. And until next time, stay safe, everybody.